All right, folks, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Torah Studies. This is our weekly journey into the soul of the Torah portion, and this week, the Torah portion is Ki Teitzei. You can find it on page 1264, 1265. There are a lot of themes, a lot of mitzvot, a lot of commandments, a lot of ideas to talk about in this week's Torah portion, but one that we'll speak about and focus on is the mitzvah of marriage. We're going to explore tonight the history of marriage, the legality of marriage, the philosophy of marriage, and the mysticism, the spirituality of marriage, and we'll walk away, hopefully, with some practical perspectives on the idea of chatuna, on the idea of wedding, marriage, and relationships. So, again, Torah portion is Ki Teitzei, 1264. So, the Torah portion, let's find the actual section that deals with marriage. It's on 1272, 1273. It's interesting because the context of marriage in the parsha, in the Torah portion, is actually in the context of divorce. It says if a person takes a woman to be his wife and then he doesn't like her. So the Torah talks about the mitzvah or the possibility of the get, of the divorce. So it's interesting how the laws of marriage are actually almost included in the laws of divorce. And I think last year, this Torah portion, we spoke about the connection between the two and the lessons that we can learn from the fact that there's this juxtaposition between marriage and divorce. But this year, we're going to focus on marriage as an entity unto itself. Like I said, the history of marriage, the legality, the laws of marriage according to Jewish law, the philosophy and the spirituality of marriage, all to come away with some practical points of guidance. Okay, so the first thing we're going to do tonight is before we get to the text inside our Torah portion, which is really the mitzvah of marriage, we're first going to explore the history of marriage. Where is the first marriage found in the Torah? I know where the first mention of tennis is in the Torah. You know the first mention of tennis?
Tennis. They served Pharaoh.
Joseph served in Pharaoh's court. I'm just saying, Joseph, he aced it. He was like,
like the first,
you missed that. You see
the
that?
First headache in the Bible.
What's
it?
First headache is?
Moses took two tablets.
Good. What's the first reference of baseball in the Torah? The first word in the big inning.
In the big inning.
Oh.
The big inning. In the beginning.
And how do we know that God is an Atlanta baseball fan?
Oh, how do we know?
No, God would be a Yankee fan.
Well, hold on. Let's find that. We have.
We say in every Amida, yeah, right? Hakel, Hagadol, Hagibor, a brave. God is a brave.
God is brave.
Yeah.
All right, that's a little bit of a stretch. That's a stretch, like Freddie Freeman reaching out to catch an errant throw. But yeah, okay. So let's bring it back to the history of marriage. Where does marriage first begin in the Torah? It goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden. Turn to your let's start. Keep the Chumash open. Keep the Chumashim open. But open up the Torah studies books or booklets to the first text. Text number one, Marnin. Please read this one. You can find it specifically on page 169. Sorry, 168.
And the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon man, and he slept, and he took one of his sides, and he closed the flesh in its place. And the Lord built the side that he had taken from man into a woman, and he brought her to man. And man said, "This time it is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. This one shall be called Isha, woman, because this one was taken from each man. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh."
So this is, thank you, this is going all the way back to the book of Genesis, back to the beginning, chapter 2. It talks about how first there's Adam, And then from his side, Sukhazan, bless you, from his side is taken Chava Eve, Ish, man, Isha, woman. Woman is taken from man. And then they come together. And the Torah says, it kind of concludes the narrative as like a kind of a prophecy, a promise, an instruction, however you want to look at it. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. The meaning of one flesh, of course, has multiple meanings. One idea is this is referring to intimacy. Another understanding of this is they become one flesh when they produce a child, when they give birth to a child together, and in that child is the oneness of the parents that were involved in the child's creation. That's how they become one flesh. They become connected within the one being of the child. Okay. But that's the first instance of what we might call marriage in the Bible. The first couple, the first coming together of a couple, is stated right here in Genesis chapter 2. But of course, we know, and this is something that Maimonides emphasizes and other sources of Jewish law emphasize, that we don't fulfill the mitzvot today because Adam and Eve did something, or because God told Adam and Eve to do something, or God told Noah to do something, or God told Abraham to do something. Rather, we fulfill the mitzvot today because God gave us the commandments either at Sinai or post-Sinai. In other words, although God gave many mitzvot before Matan Torah, before the giving of the Torah at Sinai, nonetheless, our binding obligation begins from Sinai on, which means that notwithstanding this historical source in the Torah that talks about Adam and Eve's marriage, we need to have another verse, another makar, another source that talks about the mitzvah to get married, the mitzvah to marry, and it has to come after Exodus 21 or whatever it is, wherever the giving of the Torah is stated in Exodus, it has to come after that. Indeed, as I mentioned all the way at the top of the class, in our Torah portion, all the way in the book of Deuteronomy, here we have a reference to the mitzvah of marriage. James, please read, if you will, page 1273. It's actually, yeah, it's just the first line. I mean, it gets negative really fast, as I mentioned earlier, but just read the first line of it at the top.
Yeah, it usually takes longer than a second.
This is really quick. Yeah. This turns really fast. All right, take it away.
If a man takes a wife, is intimate with her, and hates her.
Okay, and then it continues. We don't have to get into all the gory details. You can read those details if you like. The Torah then gets into, well, what is the protocol if the husband is unhappy with the wife? And of course, it also works the same way, vice versa, although the get has to be given from husband to wife, but there are grounds in the opposite way as well. Anyway, the Torah continues to talk about if there's a legitimate concern or a non-legitimate concern and the legalities of that regarding divorce. But like I said at the top, we're not talking about divorce tonight. We're talking about marriage. So here we have the source, the mitzvah of marriage. And it's really, in Hebrew, it's four words. Four short words. It's ki yikach ish isha. When or if the husband takes a wife, a man takes a woman, and the idea of taking here is in the sense of marrying her. Now, the sages.
Knowing her biblically.
Huh?
As they say,
knowing her biblically. Right. But the question is like this: how exactly does marriage happen? You see, the Torah doesn't specify. In its brief treatment of marriage, these four words, before it talks about when things don't work out and what to do then, or if things don't work out, what to do then, the Torah doesn't specify how exactly to get married. It just says, if a man takes a woman. But how does that happen? So, there is a very long analysis in the oral tradition, the oral law, the Mishnah, the Talmud, about exactly how marriage is, how it is created. What creates the bond of marriage? Clearly, there's something that has to happen for it to take effect. What has to happen? So there are three forms, three methodologies, three ways in which marriage can be affected, marriage can be created. We'll get to that in a moment. The first way, we'll get to all three in a moment, but the first way, which is the most popular, in other words, the one that we all know, is what's called kesef. What is kesef in Hebrew? What does it mean?
Money.
Kesef?
Money.
Geld, money. Kesef literally means silver, but colloquially it means money. Kesef. So what does it mean? What's kesef? How do you create marriage through kesef? It means the husband gives either money or silver or something of value to, so the man gives something of value to the woman. She has to obviously consent and acquiesce and accept it. And the intention has to be for the marriage, right? It can't be just the gift. And then she, oh, hey, would you like this? Sure. Ha ha, you're married. It's not how it works. It has to be consent. So he has to know why he's giving it to her. She has to know why. That ha ha was a little too enthusiastic there, right? It was a little too weird. But anyway, I would love to walk that back. I can't at this point. Anyway, so the husband, so he has to give it to her with that intention. She has to take it with that intention. And then when you have the transfer of value, kesef, or shaveh kesef, either
shaveh
pruta, well, it has to be at least that, yeah. Yeah. So either actual money or the equivalent, something valuable that has monetary value, when that is transferred and it's accepted with that kavana, with that intention, then you have the possibility, then you have the context for the kinyan, for the acquisition, for this reality of marriage to take effect. Now, famously, we know that in addition to the husband giving the wife something of value, there also has to be the presence of witnesses. You have to have two edim, two witnesses, two kosher witnesses that are witnessing this act of the husband giving the wife the monetary value. And then you have this this marriage created. Okay. How do we know this? It just says, ki yikach ishisha, if a man takes a woman. How do you know that we're talking about money or whatever? So famously, the Talmud says, kicha kicha miste Ephron. We talked about this last year. There's a gzereshava. Gzereshava means that there's a word that's used in one place in the Torah and a similar word that's used in a separate place in Torah. And we have a tradition that those two words are linked conceptually. Even though they're different stories, totally different narratives, one might be legalistic in nature, one might be a narrative. Nonetheless, since it uses the same terminology, it's not since it uses, it uses the same terminology and we have a tradition. We can't just find similar words and say, hey, we're throwing them together. But if there's a tradition that these concepts, these stories, these sections are linked, then you can derive one, you can take from one and apply to the other. So the Talmud says in the beginning of Tractate Kedushin, kicha kicha miste Ephron, that you derive, you have two words, ki yikach ish isha, a man takes a woman, and you also have regarding Abraham's purchase of the cave of Machpelah. Remember Abraham? He had a wife. What was his wife's name? Sarah. Sarah passes away before him. And now he wishes to bury her. And he searches for a burial plot and he finds a cave, the cave of Machpelah. And he says to the locals, I'd like to bury my wife here. And they say, well, you have to negotiate with some dude named Ephron. Ephron, yeah. So he negotiates. And initially, Ephron says, sure, take it, no problem. Abraham says, no, I want to give you money. He's like, well, okay, fine. I'll take a lot. And he charged him full price, retail.
Kesef male,
full silver, full price. No discounts. Abraham, of course, willingly pays it. But the language that's used over there in the negotiations is, I'll give you the money and I'll take the field. I'll take the property. Kicha, kach, take the property. And so the Talmud says, these two narratives are linked. It says regarding the cave of Machpelah, that it's acquired through money, that the transfer or the new reality of it being Abraham's field happens through money, through a transfer of money. So too here it says, ki yikach ish isha, when a man takes a woman, how does that happen? Also through the transfer of something of monetary value. Now I know, in many traditions, not only Jewish tradition, in many traditions, a ring is given. I wonder what the origin of that is. I know what it is in Judaism, in halacha, in Jewish law, it's because you need to give something of value from the husband to the wife at the chuppah, at the wedding, at the marriage. So you have to give something of value, has to transfer from husband to wife. And traditionally we use a ring. Some use a silver ring. Specifically, many use gold, or you use platinum. As long as it has value, and certainly it has value, we use a ring in Jewish tradition to symbolize the a perfect, unbroken connection. A circle doesn't have a beginning, doesn't have an end, doesn't have a me, and it doesn't have a you. Right? It's perfectly seamless. It's perfectly synchronistic. The idea is that the coming together of two people should be perfectly seamless. That's why traditionally the Jewish wedding ring, not necessarily the diamond or whatever it is, but the wedding band itself doesn't have any engraving, no edges, no carvings, nothing that could get in the way of that pure circle. Again, it's not legalistic, it's tradition. Let me take a step back. Those details that I mentioned about the ring and about the lack of engraving, etc., round ring, so that's the custom. But the halacha, the law is there has to be something of value given. Maimonides clarifies that there are other ways in which marriage can be effectuated. Marriage can happen, not only through the transfer of money, but also, or the transfer of something of value, but also through other means. Let's explore this inside. Text number 3. And please read this one. Text 3, back in the Torah Studies text from Rambam, Maimonides. Maimonides does a really great job of clearly elucidating the Jewish law based on all of the Talmudic discourse. He puts it down in very clear and concise language. Text 3.
Before the Torah was given, when a man would meet a woman in the marketplace and he and she decided to marry, he would bring her home, conduct relations in private, and thus make her his wife.
So he starts, Maimonides starts in his laws, Hilchot Ishut, the laws of marriage. He begins with the history. Back in the day, it wasn't so formal. You know, right? Two people, they wanted to be together, done. They went home and that was it. Continue.
Once the Torah was given, the Jews were commanded that when a man desires to marry a woman, he must acquire her as a wife in the presence of witnesses.
And of course the word acquire is using the language of the Torah. It doesn't have, I hope we can strip it of its maybe negative connotations, if it might have a negative connotation. It doesn't mean literally acquire and buy. It means, in the sense, create a kinyan, an acquisition means there's a new reality. Before something had one context, now it has another context. So the idea is that marriage is a new context and therefore requires a form of action to create that new context. Continue.
Only after this does she become his wife. This is alluded to in the verse, when a man takes a wife and has relations with her. This process of acquisition fulfills one of the Torah's positive commandments. The process of acquiring a wife is formalized in three ways: through the transfer of money, through the transfer of a formal document, and through sexual relations.
So in halacha and Jewish law, and I mentioned this before, there are actually three ways through which marriage can be effectuated: kesef, shtar, and bia. Kesef is money or monetary value. Shtar means a document, and bia means intimacy. So these are three ways through which marriage could be created. Nowadays, the way Jewish weddings have evolved, we actually have a form of all three at the wedding ceremony. Number one, the ring is given. That's the kesef. That's the monetary value. Number two, there's a shtar. There's a contract. What's the contract? The ketubah. Now, the ketubah is not really saying this contract binds the two parties in marriage. Ketubah is not exactly a marriage contract. The ketubah is, if this marriage doesn't work out, the husband is obligating himself to, the husband is obligating himself to take care of his wife while they're married, and if it won't work out, the husband is obligating himself to pay a certain amount of money toward the support of what would be then his ex-wife. So that's what, it's kind of like a prenup sort of, you know, not exactly, but that's kind of what it is. It's basically providing for the safety and secure financial security of the wife entering into this marriage. So the ketubah is not exactly the same shtar, the same document that would have been written up to create a marriage. It's not saying herein I don't know how we would write this in nice language, but herein, this document attests to the fact that so-and-so is marrying so-and-so with these witnesses. It's more of like, this marriage is happening, and this document says that she should be provided for in various ways, financially, etc. But there is this, there is a document that is written up and signed and read at a Jewish wedding today. So there's money, there's a ring, there is a document, although not that exact document. And the last, which is intimacy, the last form of the last method of marriage, is also somewhat present in the sense that there is a chuppah. A chuppah means a space. Well, it's a canopy, but it's understood to be a legal space that is officially the domain of the husband that the husband is bringing her into. And of course, there's the yichud room, which is after the chuppah, and that is a place of seclusion where, although traditionally nothing actually occurs, but something could occur in the yichud room. So therefore, we have all three represented at a Jewish wedding, at the wedding. You have the money, you have the document, and you have, again, at least conceptually, you have the possibility for the intimacy. By the way, that's if you're ever wondering what happens after the chuppah. So the husband and the wife, they go to the yichud room. There need to be two witnesses that see them enter the room, lock the door. The door is not allowed to have any windows or other openings where it's not private. It has to be completely private. And the witnesses need to stay near the door long enough that if something were to happen, it could happen. So literally, you have to stay at the door for a certain duration of time. I'm not going to tell you how long that is. Anyway, you have to stay for a certain amount of time, and then the witnesses go off on their way. And the point is, the possibility at least has been there. They have been secluded between themselves, and now their marriage has officially been cemented. So when we break down the wedding procession, but that's a different connotation. The wedding ceremony, or the marriage ceremony, the Jewish wedding, traditional Jewish wedding ceremony, it's really divided into two stages. There is the kiddushin and the nisuyin. And I'm going to explain exactly what these two are. Back in the day, before I explain exactly what they are, I will tell you this. They were separated by a full year in between the kiddushin and the nisuyin. So what is a kiddushin? What's a nisuyin? So in the English, we would say
kiddushin or erusin.
Erusin and kiddushin is halakhically the same.
Yeah.
It's erusin or kiddushin, yeah, synonymous. And then the nisuyin is the second part. So part one, part two. What are these two parts? So in English, I've seen it translated as betrothal, the first part. Kiddushin and erusin as betrothal, and then the nisuyin as the actual marriage. Semantics aside, I'll tell you what it is.
Engagement.
Kiddushin, but it's a little bit more than engagement. It's not exactly engagement. You see, so engagement means that two, at least the way we use it today, means that two people are saying that they want to get married. They want to get married, but it's not legally binding. It's they're saying they're planning on getting married, but it's not legally binding. The kiddushin, the erusin, It's like a much more serious engagement. So it's kind of like an engagement, but a more serious engagement. There's an actual commitment that's given. Now, of course, you know, even after one gets married, one is allowed to, the divorce is a possibility. But if there's divorce after the kiddushin, you still need to get, even if there wasn't the second part. Are you with me on this? Today, with an engagement, if they break off the engagement, couple breaks off the engagement, in Jewish law, you don't need to get. It's just, it is what it is. They never made it to the wedding, right? It just didn't happen. And you know, whatever. Everyone moves on and life continues. But back in the day, or not back in the day, back in the day when they would separate kiddushin, erusin or kiddushin from the nisuyin, it would actually be a state where after the first step over there, you would need an actual get to dissolve that relationship. But what are the two stages? So kiddushin or erusin, synonymous. Kiddushin means sanctification, like kiddush or kiddusha, kadosh means holy, sanctification. And what that means is, I'll use a different word, exclusivity. It's a stage where the chatan and the kala, the groom and the bride, the future husband and the future wife, the man and the woman, where they pledge exclusivity to each other. They basically say, we are going to be for each other to the exclusion of anyone else. At that stage, it's really more about excluding everyone else and not about them. And historically, what would happen is two people would meet, or they were introduced, or whatever it is, and they would want to get married. They would go through the first step of marriage, which is the Kiddushin, where they would pledge exclusivity to each other. In other words, I am yours, you are mine, to the exclusion of anyone else. But at that stage, they still weren't permitted to be with each other. They were forbidden to everyone else, but they weren't yet permitted to each other either until after stage two. So they would have about a year after they met and after they decided to get married and did the first step where they're forbidden to anyone else and also to each other, yeah, still, where they would get ready for the wedding. They would, you know, get together the resources, the money, the planning. You know, it takes some time to plan a wedding, especially back in the day. You know, you can imagine finances and whatever it was, and collect the dowry and whatever it is to get the couple set up for the future life together. And then after a year, they would have the chuppah, which is the nisuyin, the second stage, after which they would live with each other. They would get their house ready, whatever, and then they would live with each other, and they were a fully fledged married couple.
Wasn't there also during the Kiddushin there was a transfer of money as well?
At the Kiddushin there was. So the way it worked was like this. The chatan, the husband, the groom, would actually give the transfer of value, the ring or whatever it is, to the bride. She would accept it. He would say the words of Kiddushin. Hare at mikudeshet li. Behold, you are mikudeshet. Kiddushin. You're betrothed to me. Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael. In accordance with the law of Moses in Israel. He would say that with two witnesses watching. It would be Kiddushin. Betrothed. First step of married. They wouldn't live with each other. A year later, they would have the chuppah. With the blessings and a second cup of wine, or a cup of wine and the blessings and the yichurum and then the celebration, and then they would live together from then on.
So that it was more than just a ring. I mean, they would be a dowry of, you know, substance.
All you need is a ring. All you need is a ring. They would put together. They would set up the new couple in that year's time.
Okay.
But that was where the kiddush. So now at a traditional Jewish wedding today, here's what happens. The groom first approaches the chuppah and stands under the chuppah. Then the bride arrives to the chuppah. She circles around the custom. She circles around the groom seven times. Then they stand next to each other. Then the various good wishes perhaps are shared, some introductory thoughts and whatever. And then at the designated time, toward the beginning of the ceremony, the rabbi will pour a glass of wine, and there's a blessing over the wine, and then there is the ring. The ring is given from the groom to the bride, and the groom says, "Hariat mukadesh li kadat Moshe of Yisrael," and she accepts it, and the witnesses say, "Mukadeshet," she is indeed betrothed. Then the ketubah is read. And then immediately afterwards, the seven blessings, the Sheva Brachot, are recited under the chuppah, and that is the Nisuyin. In other words, the way we do it today is we compress. Both happen at the same ceremony under the same chuppah, even though the first part doesn't need to happen under the chuppah, it's really the second half. But since we've compressed it all together, so it all happens under the chuppah. Now, the two halves of the wedding are separated by the reading of the ketubah. So there are two glasses of wine as well that are poured and consumed, not the whole thing necessarily, but that are a blessing is said, and it's you take a sip from the glass, both in the context of the ring and in the context of the seven blessings, and those are the two halves of the wedding. Now let's take a look at text number four. Text number four is again Maimonides. Dan, please read this one. Text number four, Maimonides continues to talk about the Erusin, which is the Kedushin, and the Nisuyin, and he references these two stages. Take it away.
According to rabbinic law, a consecrated woman is forbidden to engage in sexual relations with her husband as long as she lives in her father's home. A man who has relations with his Erusin, in his father-in-law's home is punished with rabbinically sanctioned lashing.
Now the Arusa, again, is the one who was betrothed, the one who was the Kedushin. Again, Eris and Kedushin, it's interchangeable. Continue.
Even when the husband consecrated his wife by having sexual relations with her, he is forbidden to engage in sexual relations with her again until he brings her to his home, enters into privacy with her, and thus sets her aside as his.
So
this setting aside is referred to as entry into the chuppah, and it's universally referred to as marriage.
So we can stop right here. Anyway, bottom line is you have the Erisin and you have the Kedushin, and the point is the Erisin is step one, but even after the Erisin, sorry, you have the Erisin and the Nisuyin, even after the Erisin slash Kedushin, where they are now designated for each other, the point is that they are still not traditionally living with each other until the second half of the ceremony or the second part of the marriage happens, which is where she enters into his domain, either the chuppah or the yichurim, etc., or the house, and then they become a fully fledged married couple, etc. And that's how Maimonides concludes that they are totally permitted to each other from that time forward. Now, so the point of this is we have the history of marriage, which is Adam and Eve, a narrative, and this week's Torah portion, Ki Yikach Ish Isha, when a man takes a woman. We have the legality of marriage, legalities of marriage. We have three ways to effectuate the Kiddushin, Kesef, Shtar, Bia, money, document, or intimacy. We have two stages of the marriage. We have the Kiddushin slash Erisin, and we have the Nisuyin. We have the first part where they become exclusive to each other, or they become excluded to all others, and potentially exclusive to each other and excluded to others, but still not yet fully fledged married until we have the second stage, the Nisuyin, and that binds them together as a fully fledged married couple. And we do this today in one fell swoop, if you will, at the traditional Jewish wedding. Yes.
So can I play a little bit of a devil's advocate?
Yes.
Forgive me.
Yes.
But in the text in the Torah, it says, "Ki yikach ish isha uva eleha," and comes to her.
Right.
Right. But in Maimonides' text, the last line, which is not really literally translated, it says, "Harezu muteret lavo aleha."
Not Eleha.
Not Eleha, but he says
Aleha. Upon her.
Upon her, yeah.
Right, not to her.
Which I
don't
guess
know.
Maybe represents, you know, middle age thinking. But
I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, it's an interesting distinction. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure. We'll have to keep it in mind.
It's a
diuk. It's a diuk.
It's a sticking point with many,
That opens up a whole new discussion.
I was just being a devil's advocate.
No, it's a good point. Now let's so far so good. All makes sense. Let me tell you a story. There was a great rabbi, two great rabbis who were born in the mid 1800s, 1853 and 1858. One was Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik. He came from a town called Brisk. The Rav of Brisk.
Big deal.
He was a big deal. Reb Chaim. He was. In fact, he's such a big deal. He was such a big deal that today, in most yeshivot around the world, they study the Talmud with the Brisker method of studying. They study Talmud based on the way of analysis that he created, that he formulated, that he taught, I don't know the right way to say it, that he created. He created a way of a methodology of studying Talmud that in most yeshivot, they use till this very day. It's known as the Brisker method. It's known as Reb Chaim's way, and that's the Lithuanian way, and that's the way that most yeshivot study. Let me explain to you what this is. The way Talmud was traditionally studied is, you know, you study Talmud, and you try to understand each case and each dispute on its own merit. If there's a case and a dispute, you understand why is this opinion saying this and that opinion saying that, and each one is taken on its own. It's very, in a sense, it's a little bit disconnected. Reb Chaim, his way of looking at things was to not look at the specific singular scenario, but to take a broader view and to say, wait a second, take a step back. Why are these two rabbi sages of the Talmud, why are they disagreeing with each other in this case? And why do the same two individuals disagree in that case as well? And why do these same two individuals disagree in a different case? You could say three different cases, three different rationales. You could say that. But if you could find one rationale that runs through all three disputes, how beautiful would that be? The Brisker methodology of studying Talmud is to answer three questions with one approach as opposed to answering three questions with three different approaches. If you can answer three different questions, or if you can explain three different Talmudic disputes with the same line of thinking, that is preferred to finding three different ways of thinking. Are you with me on this? It's finding patterns, and a lot of it has to do with chakira. What is chakira? Hard to translate. Chakira is when you posit, huh?
Investigation.
But specifically in this methodology, it means when you analyze a case and you ask the question, is the reasoning behind this case because of this or because of this? And you're splitting hairs. You're splitting hairs. For example, have you ever heard of the expression glatt kosher? Glatt for meat. Glatt kosher. What does glatt mean? It's a Yiddish term.
Smooth.
Glatt means smooth. So what is glatt kosher? What, it's smooth kosher? And what's the other type of kosher? Unsmooth? Like what's the smooth business? It specifically regards meat. So one of the laws regarding a kosher meat is that the animal not only has to be a kosher type of animal, and not only does it have to be slaughtered in the specifically prescribed way of humane slaughter, not only the species of animal and the method of slaughtering the animal, but the animal, you need to do a bit of an inspection on the animal after it's been killed, slaughtered, and you need to inspect to make sure that animal that's just been slaughtered was a healthy animal. If it wasn't healthy, it's not kosher. Even though it was a kosher type of animal, and even though you slaughtered it properly, if it's not a healthy animal, in other words, if the animal was going to die on its own relatively soon, even without being slaughtered because it was just unhealthy, then it's not kosher. One of the ways of doing this autopsy, if you will, on the animal is you check the lungs. Oftentimes, a big animal, they have holes in the lung. And if there's a hole in the lung, if the lung is pierced, if there's a hole in the lung, then that animal is not kosher. Because it means that it was, at some point soon, it was going to die. How do you check to see if the animal has a hole in its lung? So you can feel it. There's a way to, in a sense, blow it up. Not blow it up, but, you know, put air into it and you see. And sometimes you have to put water on it, see if it bubbles. Whatever. There's different ways in which you can check the lung to see if it's completely healthy. The question is like this. What if there's no hole in the lung, but the lung has an adhesion? In other words, it's not perfectly smooth. It has a little bit of a bump on it. So it could be that if there's a hole in it, and then the hole kind of self-patched, right? Huh?
Scar tissue.
The problem is that, you know, when you patch something, the patch only lasts for so long. At some point, it's a little bit weaker over there, and it's not going to last. So the question is, what's the status of the patch, of the adhesion? Is it so? There's a big machloket. There's a big dispute between the author of the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, known as the Beis Yosef, the Beit Yosef, and the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Israelis. The Beit Yosef is from the Sephardic, the great Sephardic halachis.
Sephardim have to be, it's glatt kosher. They won't recognize.
So and then the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Israelis, was from Europe, and he is the father, if you will, of the Ashkenazic halacha. And there's a dispute One of them says that if it has the adhesion, it's not kosher. It needs to be glatt, perfectly smooth. No bumps. Forget about holes. No bumps even. And the other one says, even if it has some bumps, it's also okay as long as it doesn't have a hole. So the question that the Brisker Rav would ask is, what's the basis of this argument? What, they disagreed about the biology? Is that what it's about? They disagreed about, like, what's the status of an adhesion? Is it, how unhealthy is the animal? Is that what they were disagreeing about? Or is there some fundamental way of understanding this that therefore leads to the distinction in opinion? And he explains, without getting into too much detail, that the question is like this. When the animal is unhealthy, when there is an adhesion, does it mean, and we say that, let's say the adhesion is not good, does it mean that it's the adhesion that makes it not good? Or because it's not good, that's why it has the adhesion? And I know it's going to sound like the same thing, but he splits it, and we don't have time to get into it, but he splits it like this. Is it that it's because it's no good, therefore it has the adhesion, or the adhesion makes it no good? And depending on how you look at it, you have the debate. For another example of this is when it comes to the kosher signs of an animal. The Torah says that an animal, a land animal, is kosher if it both chews its cud and has split hooves. And the question is like this. Do those two signs make it kosher, or do they indicate that this is a kosher animal? In other words, does the kashrut, does the kosher status of the animal stem innately and these are manifestations of its kosherness? Or do these signs are from where the kosherness begins and that makes the animal kosher? And when you study this, you might at some point get frustrated and say, who cares? There's always a nafka mina lahalacha. There's always a practical distinction in law based on which side of the divide, this thin divide, you fall on. It's an unbelievably clever and incisive and mentally challenging way of studying Talmud. And again, this is replicated in yeshivot all over the world. So when the students study Talmud on their own, they study the Talmud, the Rashi, the Tosfot, the other commentaries, all the Rishonim, the Rashba, the Ritva, the Ran, they study all of these commentaries. And you have all these opinions, and then you come to the shir, to the lecture, twice a week, once a week. And the rabbi gets up there and he says, you learned all this stuff, now let me tell you what's driving all these different opinions. And he gives you a way of thinking where everything comes together and you have one way of looking, or two ways of looking at it, and everything falls into place, organized, arranged like a puzzle. It blows the mind to see how beautifully everything is arranged. That's the Brisker method of studying Talmud. A contemporary of his was someone who we've talked about lately a lot, Rabbi Yosef Rosen of Rogachev from Belarus, known as the Rogachev Ragon. He was also, Gaon means genius, he was an incredible genius. He also explained Torah and Talmud and Jewish law in a similar fashion, but instead of using strictly legalistic principles, he used often philosophical and spiritual principles to explain the law. Philosophical principles drawn oftentimes from Maimonides' Guide for the Perplexed, and other spiritual philosophical guides, to then draw incredible parallels and explain disagreements and concepts in Jewish law. So the story goes like this: one time, the Rogachev Ragon was visiting Reb Chaim Brisker, and Reb Chaim Brisker sees him and he says, "Mazel tov." Mazel tov. So the Rogachev says, what's the mazel tov for? He says, mazel tov on your wedding. This was a joke. How do you understand the joke? Let me explain. To explain this joke, and I'll tell you soon what the Rogachev answered, and it was, you'll see how it's funny. I know right now you're like, what is that? Hold on, give me a second. To explain all of this, we need to introduce two contradictory teachings of Maimonides and the Rogachev's explanation, which led to Reb Chaim Brisker's joke to the Rogachev. So what are the two competing Maimonides teachings? Maimonides teaches, and this is text number 5, Maimonides teaches that when it comes to a bracha, when it comes to a blessing, there are certain blessings that you need to say in the moment, and if you missed it, you can't say it later. There's a blessing that's recited when you shake the lulav and the etrog. There's a blessing that's recited when you do that. When you do that mitzvah. Or when you eat the matzah. If you did the mitzvah, but you didn't do the, but you didn't say the blessing, can you say it later? Or did you or did you miss your chance? So he says like this. Maimani says in text 5. Alex, please read text 5.
A person who performed a mitzvah, but mistakenly did not recite a blessing. If the fulfillment of the mitzvah still continues, he may recite the blessing even though he already performed it. If the mitzvah is a deed that is completed, he should not recite a blessing.
And he continues to describe various examples of each, and I'll say them outside in the interest of time. Basically, if the mitzvah is a one-and-done thing, you did it and it's over, you can't now say a blessing for what happened. It's too late. You missed it. If it's a mitzvah that you're still doing, then you can still recite the blessing. For example, if you're still wrapped in your talit and your prayer shawl and you forgot to say the blessing when you initially wrapped it, you can still say it because you're still wrapped in it. Because the blessing is to wrap myself in the talit. I'm still wrapped in it. I'm a Jewish rapper. So I'm still wrapped in it, right? It's still fine. But if it's a one and done, like I already shook the lulav, I'm not shaking anymore. Right? I'm not doing the shake. So at that point, I can't, the blessing's over. So Maimonides gives you a simple idea. If it's a one and done, in other words, if you did it and it's finished, and you didn't say the blessing, too late. If it's still ongoing, then you could still recite the blessing. Comes along text 6.
The wedding blessings may be recited even after several days of marriage.
Maimonides rules in Hilchot Ishut, the laws of marriage, that when it comes to a wedding, what's about a wedding? You can still recite the blessing after the marriage ceremony, even a few days. And this boggles the mind. Maimonides already set forth the principle in his laws of the blessings, that if it's a one and done, too late. If you missed it and it's a one and done, too late. Only if it's still ongoing can you still say the blessing. When it comes to marriage, right? When was the ceremony? I don't know. Whenever it was, but it's in the past. If you somehow forgot to say the blessing at the ceremony, you would think that the ruling would be, can you say it a few days later? What would you think the ruling would be? You would think no. You guys are jumping the gun. You would think no because the wedding, it's for the effectuating the marriage. It's already done. So, but Maimonides rules that you could say it later. Comes along the Ragachavar, and in one of his writings, halachic writings, he says why? Because the status of marriage, the mitzvah of marriage, is not just. In other words, when do you get getting married is a mitzvah, right? The marriage is a mitzvah. It's not a one-time deal. It's rather, in the language of the Ragachavar, it's a pu'ula nimshechet, which means an ongoing or constant action that continuously happens. It's something that continuously renews and regenerates and reactivates every single day. And that's why you're constantly getting married, which is why when the Ragachavar went to visit Reb Chaim Brisker, he said, Mazel Tov on the chasen and Mazel Tov on the wedding. He says, you got married today. Right? Because every day is again getting married. It's a pula nimshechet. Upon which the Ragachavar said, but your Mazel Tov that you wish me at my wedding is also pula nimshechet. And since you wished me Mazel Tov then, the Mazel Tov that you told me is still ongoing. You don't have to say it again. My wedding is ongoing. Your Mazel Tov is also ongoing. We're good. That's how these great geniuses kind of sparred in halachic discourse. Here's the important salient piece of information that we want to extract from this. When it comes to marriage, so you know, you would think that what marriage is when what creates the wedding creates the bond. And then they continue. But that coming together, that the marriage that puts them together is a one-time deal. And then afterwards, they just are together. The Rogachev is saying, not just they are married. I mean, that's obvious. That they're still married, and unless they're not, yeah, of course they're still married. But that the, in essence, the process by which they came together is happening again each and every single day or each and every single moment. That's the innovation. Not that they're still married. Of course they're still married if they're not married. But it's that the wedding, what happens at the wedding, when you say the blessing about coming together, that coming together happens again and again and again. When it comes to marriage, it also is when it comes to Brit Milah, circumcision, it's considered, if the blessing wasn't recited, it could be recited even at a later time, because the Milah is considered to be, the circumcision is considered also to be a Pula Nimshechet. Pula Nimshechet. It's considered to be an ongoing, constant thing.
Says after several days have passed.
Yeah.
Which suggests
it's not exactly translated properly.
Must not be
yeah, translated. No, it's not. Not at all, actually.
Yeah, because I mean, then it would say that
it wouldn't need that time.
It wasn't ongoing.
Right. It's like after a few days, well, then you're out. Yeah. It's the point is, even at a later time, you can still recite the blessing. And again, the Rogachev explains, take a look at text 7. You know what? Let's read the Rogachev himself. Karen, go ahead. Text 7.
Text 7. According to the approach I have proposed in a number of places, Maimonides is of the opinion that marriage is renewed every day. It is not enough that one acquired a legal married status in the past.
In other words, like you think, I got my marriage license, right? I got it. And now we're just married, but we don't need to get married. The point is, it's halachically, it's like the couple is getting remarried constantly. Which is why the blessing could be recited at any moment, at a later point in time. And why, again, Reb Chaim Brisker said, Mazel Tov to the Rogachever, you know, tongue in cheek. Okay. By the way, the Rogachever takes this idea of Pula Nimshechet from, the Rogachever takes it from Maimonides' guide for the perplexed, where he talks about how Hashem's, God's effect in the world is also a Pula Nimshechet. God is constantly doing things and causing things and bring about things in the world. It's not a one-time deal that God created heaven and earth, but God has an ongoing relationship with the world. So the Rogachev, again, drawing this philosophical concept and applying it to halacha, says the same thing is true in marriage. It's not just a one-time deal, but there's a constant coming together. The Rebbe then explains, different like a tale of three generations, Maimonides, the Rogachev, and then the Rebbe. The Rebbe famously got smicha from the Rogachev. The Rebbe says the following, why is it that marriage is a Pula Nimshechet? How do you define which mitzvahs are one-time deal and which are constantly regenerating? And what's the rationale behind it? And the Rogachev doesn't explain it fully, so the Rebbe explains it. And he says like this. When you have a mitzvah, or when you have a reality that is paradoxical in nature, in other words, it's an impossibility, then you need it to constantly be regenerating to make that impossibility a possibility. Right? As long as there, if it makes sense, then it could be one and done. You don't need to keep on doing it. But if it's impossible to make the impossibility possible, which is why you need to have it ongoing, which is why the Alter Rebbe in Tanya explains, this is text number 8. It's a very long text and I'm going to paraphrase it. Text number 8, the Alter Rebbe says, that God's giving life to the world is an ongoing reality. It's not a one-time deal. We've discussed this many times in various classes. Why? Because existence is an impossibility. The Jewish Kabbalistic understanding of creation is yesh me'ayin, something from nothing. Which means it's not like there is something preceding or predating the world, something of this nature that this world is drawing from, if you will. It is something physical, something from absolute nothingness. For that paradox to even exist requires a constant regeneration of that impossibility. Because, so when an artist takes paint, right? Bob Ross takes paint and puts it on the canvas. Always has to be a Bob Ross mention. And you put on the canvas, you don't need the artist to be constantly there because he took an existing thing and refashioned it, and it still existed before him. It existed after him. It doesn't need him to exist. But something that cannot exist and is being forced into existence, that can only happen so long as that force is forcing it into existence. My favorite example is a football example. You throw a football in the air. So somebody sees the football flying through the air. 70 yards, this quarterback just did 67 yards in the air. Mahomes in Kansas City, just now in the preseason a few days ago. Doesn't matter. Here's the point. Somebody would say, I'm studying, I have a theory that there are two types of footballs. The footballs that sit still and the footballs that fly. So they're flying footballs. The other person will say, are you kidding me? Flying footballs. Some guy threw it in the air. That's why it's flying. It's not a flying football. And what's the proof? The moment the energy, the force that is propelling it into the air stops, it returns and it lands and it remains as inert and dead as the other football. So yeah, it looks like a different football. It's the same football. In other words, it only flies against its nature as long as there's a force constantly pushing it. The moment that force stops, it drops. Are you with me on this?
Did somebody catch it?
We hope. If it's our guys, yes. If it's the other guys, we hope it was caught the other way. Anyway, the point is like this. Something that can't be, if it's made to be, is only being as long as it's being made to be. Does that make any sense?
Yes.
It should make sense.
Say it one more time, though.
Something that's being made to be is only being like that as long as it's being made to be. It doesn't take on that new reality if it's truly a paradox. If it's not a paradox, then it just assumes that new form and it goes on. But if it's truly an impossibility, it can only be that impossibility as long as being forced into existence. So therefore, the Rebbe says, the Ragachavar is explaining those mitzvot that are considered to be pulanim shechet are the ones that are impossibilities, the ones that are paradoxes. So, for example, creating a covenant with God in the flesh, which is Brit Milah, which is circumcision, that the physical body should be a covenant to God, the physical should be a covenant to the spiritual, to God, the finite to the infinite, is impossible. That can only be if that's constantly happening. And he gives another example of Hekdesh, where you donate your stuff to the temple, right? To the holy temple of old. So when you donate it, it becomes a different status. It becomes Hekdesh, it becomes sanctified. So that sanctification is considered to be an ongoing thing, because for physical, mundane substance to become sanctified, to totally change its reality, is again something that needs an ongoing effort, it's an ongoing reality. And the Rebbe explains the same thing is true with our feature topic, which is marriage. If marriage made sense, right? If marriage made sense, it wouldn't need to be a pula nimshechet. It wouldn't need to be constantly regenerated, because it's not a paradox. But because marriage is such a paradox, right? Women are from, no, men are from
Mars.
And women are from Venus, right? Or men are from Zah, and women are from Malchut for our Kabbalists amongst us. Or, according to some of the texts here, based on the 13 attributes of mercy, men are from Notzer, and women are from Nake. Right? So when you have these two different, completely different realities, two completely different worlds and realities and perspectives, when you have that, to have them come together as one is the ultimate paradox and impossibility. And for that to be, for that to be sustained requires a constant, conscious effort to keep it together. Which is why the Rebbe explains, the Ragachavar says, that the marriage is not a one-time deal. There's no way that because we stood under the chuppah and we were happy then, that that's going to translate at any further point in the relationship together, that it therefore should be, you know, totally fine and everything amazing. It requires a constant regeneration. Just like the couple committed and came together under the chuppah, that is an ongoing process. And here we have a melding of the spiritual, the philosophical, the halachic, and the practical, all in one law. The law of Maimonides, the law written up by Maimonides, where Maimonides articulates that the blessing of the wedding can be recited even at a later point in time, teaches us the essence of marriage. And that is that it takes work and it's a constant effort to keep the two, to put the two, to work with the two together, because it's such a paradox. If it wasn't a paradox, it would be easy. It would be easy. It wouldn't take any subsequent effort, right? You create a sculpture. It's not fighting against you. You create it. You leave it, and it sits, and it stays the way it is. The Mona Lisa, it's not going anywhere. She's not smiling any more or any less when you walk in to the Louvre. It's in the Louvre, right? I just say it in a weird way. That's where it is, right? The Louvre, right? So it's not smiling more or less based on how you come into the room. Marriage, a little bit different, right? The other, their disposition will change based on your disposition. Yours will change based on theirs. It's a moving target. And it's because at its core, it's the convergence of inherent opposites. It's the great paradox. It's what some have called the comedy of marriage. God wanted to have fun, so he said, "Hey, let's try this out and see how it works for you." But again, I don't mean to be cynical in any way. The point is, just humor, it's not cynical. The point is that the legality of the permission to recite the blessing at a later time in marriage reminds us of the paradox of marriage and reminds us of what relationships call forth from us, which is to constantly regenerate and work on it and recommit to it in an ongoing fashion. So that's it. That's it. We skipped some texts. By the way, text 12, let's do one more text. It's not going to make sense perfectly, but hopefully it'll make a little bit of sense, huh?
Let's do it anyway.
Let's do it anyway. That's the best. The best texts are the ones that don't really make sense. David, please read this one. The final text, text 12. The Rebbe explains why sometimes we say, "Mazel tov, mazel tov," and we say it twice.
They are in
no, no.
This
text 12. Text 12. May the wedding be. You see that?
Uh-oh.
Oh, my gosh. I'm sorry. Is there a "may the wedding be in a good and auspicious hour"? 13. At least it's there. Is that the last text, though, in the class?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Perfect. The last text. Text 13. Lucky 13.
Okay. "May the wedding be in a good and auspicious hour, and with mazel tov." Mazel tov as is the regular phrase used in the context of marriage. This corresponds to the two mazels, notzar and nake?
Yeah.
Notzar and nake. In a marriage,
that's
the mazels merge.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. In a marriage, the mazels merge. The mazel, huh?
Say that fast.
Say that very fast. 13 attributes of mercy. One of them is notzer, huh?
In a marriage, the mazels merge. I'm
Oh, in a marriage, the mazel merge. Yeah, I just got. Yeah, it's alliteration. Yes,
yeah.
So that's what you meant. What it means, the short of it is that men come from notzar and women come from naka. They mean different things. Notzar means preservation. Notzar chesed, God preserves kindness, and vinaka, and he gets rid of iniquity. These are the 13 attributes. This is how Moses prayed to God to forgive the Jewish people for the golden calf. He talked about God's mercy and God's forgiveness. So God preserves his kindness and God purges the sin, cleanses the sin. It's preserving and purging. Two different movements. One is keeping and one is getting rid of. So men come from notzer, which is keep, again, how it translates into, we'll leave that for another class, another time.
So when they kick you out of the bedroom, it's not okay?
Well, 1 second, we're not... Slow it down. So men come from notzer, and women come from naka. The point is, the Rebbe says, that's why, this is all based on the Rizal text, the other text, previous text, explain that, or at least cite it. So the Rebbe says, that's why we say mazel tov, because they both come from individual sources. One mazel for the husband, one mazel for the wife, two different sources of mazel. Mazel means influence. Mazel means like constellations and influence. It's different stars, different, totally different dimensions. So the point is that at a wedding we say mazel tov with the understanding that this is a paradox. This is an impossibility. And for it to be ongoing, or for it to happen, it takes ongoing effort. And that's reflected in the blessings. And that's also a call to action. Whether it's in our marriage and our other relationships, relationships, especially those filled with paradox, require lots of work and positivity. May we work at our relationships and experience very healthy relationships and only blessings in our lives. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for another wild and woolly edition of Torah Studies. Thank you. Thank you for that gentle applause. We wouldn't want